Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Our topic is gospel history, and basically what we're going to try to do is we're going to survey some recent liberal attempts to rewrite the life of Christ. And that's not a totally pleasant thing to survey, and yet it's a real thing, and something we need to know something about. Then we're going to try and look at what actual information we've got from history about Jesus, from antiquity about Jesus. And then we're going to come back and, having shown that the really primary historical sources about Jesus are the Gospels, we want to learn something about the authorship and date and the purposes and such and reliability of these Gospels. What I'm going to try and do is discuss the key things, liberal lives of Christ, in the first session, what we might call earlier liberal lives of Christ, and in the second session, what we will call recent liberal lives of Christ, making the division, say, around shortly after 1900, the last of the earlier liberal lives of Christ. And there's kind of a big break until just 20 years ago or so, and we'll pick up again there. What we're going to do is look at what we might call liberal lives of Christ. And by liberal here, I don't mean people who are generous as opposed to stingy. I suppose liberal as opposed to conservative would be what I have in mind here, and I do not have particularly a political question in mind. There may be some linkage between political liberalism and religious liberalism, but I'm talking here about theological liberalism. Theological liberalism, I'm not sure can be defined in two words, but basically relates to a rejection of the miraculous, a rejection of real revelation from God, and a replacement by the idea that modern man knows enough about the universe that he can correct ancient writers and tell them what really happened, or at least what didn't happen, and explain how the universe really functions. The term liberalism used to be called modernism back early in this century, the modernist fundamentalist controversy, which really a controversy, really a fight between liberals on the one hand and Orthodox Christians on the other hand. And it revolved around 4, 5, 6, possibly 7 points of basic Christian doctrine, which came to be called the fundamentals. And so fundamentalists meant, at the turn of the century and even into the 30s and beyond, persons who held to certain fundamental doctrines of Christianity. And theological liberals and modernists were certain ones who rejected certain fundamental doctrines of Christianity, which, of course, they didn't think were fundamental doctrines of Christianity, but just the peripheral matters. These doctrines, one of them was the occurrence of miracles, and we're going to see that one is going to come up again and again and again and again. Miracles, according to liberals, do not happen. The even closed system of cause and effect. The second one is the deity of Christ. And then the numbering gets a little trickier, but it's common to emphasize the virgin birth of Christ. The Bible is quite clear, really happened. In arguments whether God had to do it that way or not, I don't know the answer to all that. But this is what the Bible says did happen. What we call the substitutionary atonement. Now, it gets a little trickier at this point, trying to decide what to use as fifth. Second coming is commonly used. Several other suggestions can be made in that. So there's been some disagreement on exactly where to make the numbers there. These features don't guarantee a person's an Orthodox Christian if they hold all of those, if we understand Orthodox to mean has a saving faith, because if we look at that, we find out that standard Roman Catholicism holds all those points, and yet they're very seriously mistaken on the nature of salvation, how one is saved, what part we play in it, whether we earn any of it, whether the saints earn any of it, of course, etc. But this is a very crucial distinction between theological liberalism and Orthodox Christianity. I haven't got time here to get into a long discussion of the rise of theological liberalism, but suffice to say that it begins to arise in the 1600s and 1700s with the beginning of a belief that we understand so many laws in the universe, it's not necessary to postulate a God intervening to explain the phenomena of nature. And so you begin to see at first certain persons who we might call deists, who believe that God made the universe, but he made it like a clock and wound it up and let it run down by itself. He made it, he started it, but he doesn't interfere with it. And then later on, you begin to get other forms of liberalism, a form of liberalism in which everything is a part of God, what we would call pantheism of some sort, of moving over in that direction, and various other types of that sort. Well, we don't want to get into a long discussion of that. What I'd like to discuss is some of the major attempts to see a different Jesus in the Bible from a theological liberal perspective than the one the Bible actually presents. And I'm going to look with you this evening at five of a whole class here. I'm trying to figure out where I managed to lay my chalk. There it is. There have actually been an enormous number of Lives of Christ written in the last few centuries. And Albert Schweitzer, in his book, Quest for the Historical Jesus, sketches over 100 of them, over 100 liberal Lives of Christ, written from the late 1700s till about 1906. There. And this book, though Albert Schweitzer himself is liberal, is actually a pretty good antidote to liberal attempts to rewrite the life of Christ. After you've read 100 different ones, you kind of get the idea they don't really know who Christ is, and they really can't decide among themselves who Christ is and such. We want to look at five of these men. The earliest one, Rimarus. Paulus. Sprouts. Renan. And Breda. The first fellow we want to look at here is Herman Samuel Rimarus. Herman Samuel Rimarus was a professor in Germany. He was a deist. That is, one who believes that Christianity is wrong. There's a God, there's a creator, all right, but this creator doesn't intervene in the universe, that you don't need revelation to understand what God is like, that man's not so bad that he needs to be saved from anything. Rimarus, in seeking to propound the deistic view of reality, felt he had to deal with Jesus. How do you explain Jesus? And his attempt was put together in several little short sketches that he wrote up. He was putting together a big manuscript, several thousand pages. He was afraid to publish it. At that time in Germany, Orthodox Christianity was rather strong, and there would have been a very huge outcry against anyone who published it. So he put together this material and shared it with some friends, and that's it. And then he died. But after his death, one of his friends decided this stuff should not remain unpublished, so that he ought to spread the good news around, essentially, among other people who felt that way. And so this friend of his, a librarian in Germany, basically took some fragments out of the work that Rimarus had done and published them. And two of those fragments, which he did not tell, by the way, who had written these things, one of them was Rimarus' explanation of the resurrection, and the other one was the explanation of what Jesus had in mind and what the disciples had in mind. And this begins your liberal Lives of Christ, at least in any kind of scholarly circles. Schweitzer deals with a couple Lives of Jesus that were constructed by Freemasons, but this was constructed by liberal deists. Basically, what Rimarus does is he claims that Jesus really thought he was Messiah. And by Messiah, Jesus meant what the Jews meant. And the Jews expected somebody to show up and deliver them from Rome, throw out the Romans, make the Jewish nation the chief nation on earth, and that sort of thing. And so Jesus intended to be a military commander of some sort. He certainly did not intend to found any kind of religion. Rimarus is willing to grant that maybe Jesus did some kind of healings, but Rimarus doesn't believe in miracles. Rimarus doesn't believe Jesus can do miracles on anybody else, so the kind of healings Jesus is supposed to have done are the kind of healings which he would say Catherine Kuhlman might do, or Oral Roberts might do. And one of the features you're going to find in liberalism is liberalism thinks that early Christians were like Pentecostals, and Pentecostals think early Christians were like Pentecostals. But those in the middle don't think early Christians were quite like that. So you had a little bit of divergence in that direction. Well, Jesus' attempts to start a revolt fail, and he's put to death for attempting to do so. Probably the disciples had the same thing in mind at this time, according to Rimarus. They expected Jesus to deliver them from the Romans and set up a great Jewish nation to control the world, or at least to control Palestine. But suddenly Jesus is dead. Disciples are far struck by that. But in just a day or so, it begins to sink in on them that If Jesus is dead, they're going to have to go back to work. Now, as all of you know, pastors never do anything except stand up for half an hour on Sunday morning and preach. It's a pretty cushy life. And so if they had to get out of that, had to go back to working, that was really going to be tough. So according to Reimarus, they decide that they're going to start themselves a religion. So according to Reimarus, the disciples slip into the tomb and steal Jesus' body out. Then they wait till the third day, and the other women go down there and discover the empty tomb. Wow, Jesus has disappeared. But they're not quite ready to announce it publicly for fear that somebody might be able to find the body and recognize him. So they wait for 40 days until Jesus' body would be decayed sufficiently and couldn't be recognized. And then they begin to preach publicly, and they start this new religion. We see with Reimarus then a claim that Jesus is really very different when he comes across in the Gospels. Instead of one who is bringing principally a deliverance from sin, instead of principally a deliverance from other people's oppression, and instead of seeing Jesus who is one who is really God, they see him as one who is the Messiah in a purely military sense, and instead of seeing a real resurrection, they see a fraud. And this is a type of theory for the resurrection that is spun off from Reimarus and turned on all the way down to this time. You will still see liberals today, not all of them, some liberals today who claim that the resurrection is a fraud, that the disciples intentionally stole the body and carried him off. Reimarus, of course, is going to point to the remarks in Matthew where the soldiers come back from the tomb and they are bribed to tell people, the disciples came while we were asleep and stole his body. Of course, it's a little tricky to figure out how you bear testimony of what happened while you were asleep, but basically, Reimarus is going to believe the story of the soldiers rather than the story of the disciples. Well, that's a very quick sketch of what Reimarus is doing. Reimarus's book created the parts of the book that were published after Reimarus's death created a sensation at that time. And the family of Reimarus was very unhappy about it and tried to stop the book's publication. It did become known fairly quickly that Reimarus was behind the book, even though it was published as an anonymous work. The trouble was, of course, that many of Reimarus's friends had seen the book, had seen the fragments in manuscript form, and the word got out fairly quickly who had really written it, and so they were very perturbed. But the book was already rolling by that time, and it's had a fairly big impact. And yet, Reimarus was outside Christian circles. He considered himself a deist, not a Christian. He did not consider himself a Christian. And yet, we see the beginning of an attack on Christianity in this whole area. There, of course, had been attacks earlier, particularly back in the first few centuries, there have been attempts to attack Christianity along the lines of, well, claiming his body was stolen was, in fact, the very response that the Jewish leaders put together within a few hours. And such attacks have continued for pagan sources, Jewish sources, up until Constantine took the Roman Empire over, and various other attacks on Christianity came from Islam and such. But this marks the beginning of a concerted attack on the life of Jesus, if you like, from persons from a Christian culture and attempting to influence Christianity directly. Yes. The next fellow we want to look at is Paulus. These guys all got front names. As you guess, this is the back name here, Reimarus, Herman Samuel Reimarus, and this fellow, even worse, Heinrich Eberhard Gottlob Paulus. I need my notes in front of me to keep track of that one. Both of them German professors. One big difference. This fellow was a professor of Oriental languages. This fellow was a professor of theology. The step that takes place between Reimarus, and I should have given you some dates there for his publication. Reimarus' work was published after his own death. The various fragments came out over a five-year period from 1774 to 1778, so just about the time of the American Revolution. And Reimarus had died in 1768, so they came out 6 to 10 years after his own death. Paulus now, we move over into the 19th century, and Paulus published his work in 1828, His Life of Jesus. Paulus, as I say, is professor of theology. Paulus had a little different background than Reimarus did. Reimarus, deist. Paulus, his father was a spiritist. You know, one of his seances, and Paul thought the spirit of the dead and all that sort of thing. But he had reacted very violently against that and rejected the idea of any kind of spirit beings and such. And so he put together his Life of Jesus. Again, a rather long work, but this one published in its entirety, a couple volumes, about 1,200 pages, but Pope published openly during his lifetime. So here's a fellow who doesn't consider himself Christian, here's a fellow who considers himself Christian. Here's a fellow who's not a professor of theology, he's a professor of theology. This fellow published after his death because of fear of what would happen. Now, because this has been around and some other material has been around attacking Christianity, this could be presented in a more open way. And this fellow claims he's not attacking Christianity. I'm just trying to show you what really happened, and Jesus is really a good guy and all of that. Emphasis of Ray Morris. More here on a liberal direction, not a deist. One who considered himself a Christian. Jesus is a great moral teacher. But since moral truth is eternal, you can deduce it by reason. You don't have to have a revelation about moral truth. Jesus is not teaching any kind of new religion. He's just making known truths that were already around before. Well, we're not going to give you any great tour of Paulus's life of Christ, except to look at the one point which he is different from the ones before, and in which he has a big influence down the years, and that is his treatment of miracles. Basically, Morris had looked at one miracle, the resurrection, and said it was a fraud. The disciples carried the body off, and had looked at one other set of things, the healings, and said they're psychosomatic healings. They're the kind of thing a person can do if he's got a charismatic personality. They're the type of thing a person can do if he knows a little hypnotism, that sort of thing. Paulus, however, says the events that are described in the Bible's miracles really happened, but they were really natural phenomena. The disciples were just a little on the dense side, and they didn't recognize that these things were natural phenomena. Jesus, for instance, was healing people by means of some unknown spiritual power that works on the nervous system, but it's not supernatural. You're looking at Jesus as maybe a early practitioner of ESP of some sort, and he's able to reach in with his mind and do something to the nervous system and make your diseases straighten up. And Jesus used medicine. Remember when he put the clay on the fellow's eyes, and when he put the little spittle on the fellow's eyes. He's really using medicine there. And he used diet. Diet. I don't remember Jesus using anything about diet. Well, sure, he said, these kind don't go out except by prayer and fasting. Use diet, etc. So what you kind of get in Paulus is sort of the stuff you might hear in health food circles today. I'm not all health food people, by the way. That sort of idea that, you eat right, you'll live right, and you'll last longer, and all of that sort of thing. So the sort of thing you might see somewhat in holistic medicine and health food circles today, a little bit of that you see in Paulus. Well, in general, what you're going to see in liberal circles regarding healings is an attempt to make a non-supernatural healing and saying it's psychosomatic in some way, but they didn't have that terminology at this period. So Paulus is going in that direction. But what does he do with the nature of miracles? At least take a little bit more imagination, but he uses the same scheme. What you saw, what you see in the biblical material really happened, but wasn't supernatural. You say it wasn't supernatural, it sounded like Jesus was walking on the water. Paulus would say, no, he was walking along the shore. Or he was walking on a sandbar, and the disciples thought he was walking on the water. And so naturally, when Peter jumps out of the boat, he's not standing on the sandbar, so he goes right to the bottom. And that's why he doesn't float. Jesus reaches out and pulls him up, of course. So that would be one sort of idea that he would deal with.
And how did Jesus get there?
Well, so he walks out on a sandbar and towards the boat like this. Peter steps out, splash, reaches down and pulls him up, etc. You have to stage it just right, okay. But since we're 2,000 years away from the event, Paulus can put his sandbars anywhere he wants, you know. And we don't know exactly where he was in the Sea of Galilee. But this is typical of what Paulus is doing. And as soon as he gets in the boat goes behind a little point of land and it's out of the wind and the water just calms down, etc. Jesus somehow says the right words at the right time, such. What about the feeding of the 5,000? Well, this is probably the one miracle that Paulus's that has been carried on regularly in the liberal circles today. And the idea here is that of those 5,000 people there, 2,500 of them had big lunches hidden under their cloaks. But they were afraid to pull it out because, as far as they knew, the other 4,999 people didn't have any lunch. And as soon as you pulled out yours, they'd all dive on you and drag it away from you, etc. They're afraid to bring it out. And when this little boy brought out his 5 loaves and 2 fish, everybody got ashamed and they dragged out their lunches. And naturally, there was enough for everybody to go around. And so you'll very regularly see in liberal commentaries and liberal sermons that the whole thing about the feeding of 5,000 is about sharing. And there's a little bit about sharing in the thing. The boy was willing to share his lunch. But I think the big thing that they missed, because they rejected the miraculous, is the feeding of 5,000 tells you something about Jesus as the Creator. And it has a comparison with the manna in the wilderness and several things that draw your attention to this is the prophet greater than Moses. This is the one who doesn't give you a message from God that there's going to be this stuff laying on the ground and it is there the next day, but he prays and suddenly this multiplies in front of you, etc. It's intended to remind us of what happened with Elijah. I believe it's Elijah. Elisha. You may have to check that. Where he sets 20 loaves on the table in front of 100 men. And you're not talking about huge loaves like this, but little loaves like this. And there's enough to go around because somehow the bread multiplies in some way. Well, that's the picture we have here. But that's not the picture Paulus says. Paulus goes off in a very, very different direction to solve the matter. What about the transfiguration? Well, here Peter, James, and John are up on the hillside with the Jesus all night. And by the time morning is coming around, they're pretty tired. And so they dozing off to sleep. Suddenly you hear something, and you look up, and there are two men standing beside Jesus. And just that moment, the sun's coming up, and the sun lights up all the fog around them, lights up these guys, and shines through the back of their hair. So they look like they're glowing like angels almost. And you can see they weren't quite awake because of what Peter says. It's kind of the sort of thing you'd say if you're half asleep. And so you say, let's build some tabernacles here or something. And then apparently they doze off or something, two guys disappear. And what they don't really realize is these are two secret disciples of Jesus from Jerusalem who came up to talk to him and they go away. They'll show up later, by the way, before we're finished here. But that's what's going on there. What about the resurrection of Lazarus and the resurrection of the widow's son and the resurrection of Jairus' daughter? In all of these, Paul suggests that the person's in a coma. But Jesus, somehow looking at the person, recognizes the symptoms. Just how you do that when Lazarus is wrapped up inside the tomb and such, I'm not sure. But anyway, according to Apollos, he recognizes the symptoms. It's a coma, and he wakes the person up. Just how you wake a person up from a coma when you walk up to them is another trick. But I suppose he's having Jesus with all kinds of ESP, reaching into their nervous system and turning it on and such. So all he claims is that these were resurrections from premature burial. With those three events, Lazarus, the widow's son, and Jairus' daughter being a resurrection from a coma, we're probably not too surprised then to hear that Jesus' resurrection is a resuscitation from a coma. According to Paulus, Jesus did not die on the cross, he went into a coma. And he's taken down from the cross in a coma. And he's put in a cool tomb. And sometimes when you touch something cool, it can wake you up. And he had all these spices around him, and the strong smell of them woke him up, perhaps. And then, kind of a little early 19th century medicine, he had been bled by the spear wound in the side. And back at that time, doctors thought it was really good medicine to bleed people a little bit. Sometimes they overdid it. I think they took a couple quarts out of George Washington, turned his cold into a pneumonia, and killed him. But at Paulus' time, this was still thought to be pretty good medicine. So the spear wound bled him a little bit, got in the cold tomb, aromatic spices, and he woke up. Just then, as luck would have it, remember, he can't very well have much providence going on here, liberal theologians. There's an earthquake and it rolls the stone just the right way, so it opens up the tomb, and Jesus walks out. How he walks to Galilee on nail-pierced feet, Paulus never explains, but that's what he does. And he appears to the disciples, and they think he's alive, and they think he's risen from the dead. And then finally, Jesus is with his disciples down in Jerusalem, and he's about to leave them. They're standing on the Mount of Olives, and he walks up the hillside into the clouds. That's the ascension. Hard to see how the disciples could mistake that, but that's the way Paulus goes with it. The angels, they're the two guys that were at the Transfiguration. These dedicated higher, upper-class men from Jerusalem. Well, I think you can see from Paulus's explanations here, straining considerably at the data. He strained so much at the data that very, very few liberals have been willing to go that way. Most of them felt rather absurd to try and handle things that way. But one very important fact about Paulus's work is we now see the spreading of liberal views into Christian circles and outside Christian circles a generation earlier than this. Now, by the early 1800s, they're coming already into Christian circles, and we see the beginning of the spread of what we call theological liberalism within Christianity, and it gradually takes over the mainline denominations, nearly every one of them in the United States today, nearly every one of the mainline denominations. is dominated by liberal theologians. The rationalizing approach to miracles we've discussed to Paulus is a characteristic feature of him, generally ridiculed by liberals today, but still partially accepted and used by some, particularly in cases like the sharing of the lunches as a solution to the feeding the 5,000. Move on to the third fellow here, David Friedrich Strauss. Just a few years later, that was 1832 that Strauss's work came out, whereas Paulus' work came out in 1832. Strauss also writing A Liberal Life of Christ. Whereas Paulus was a respected professor of theology at a German university, Strauss was just out of university, just in his first teaching position, when as a young man, let's see, he's only 27 years old when this book comes out, he cranks out A Life of Jesus, a shorter work, and a work that had a very large impact at the time, because whereas there were many liberals who were willing to go along in the direction of Paul, they weren't willing to go where Strauss wanted to take them. Strauss' basic idea is that much of the life of Jesus is mythological. From our remember, much of the description of what's going on in the Gospels is historical, but Jesus was a Jewish-type Messiah, not a Christian Messiah, and his resurrection was a fraud, and his healings were fake. Paulus, all of the things in the Gospels happened, they're just misunderstood by the disciples, presuming that miraculous really happened. Strauss, they didn't really happen. Strauss had gotten an idea from one of his professors, very important German philosopher, Hegel, that the most important things in reality are ideas, not matter, not people, ideas. And he applied that to Gospels. And so what he came up with is if the ideas the Bible teach are really important, it doesn't matter whether they ever happen or not. And so the virgin birth is an idea that teaches a spiritual lesson, but it didn't really happen. The deity of Christ is an idea that teaches a spiritual lesson, but it didn't really happen. The second coming is an idea that teaches a spiritual lesson, but it won't really happen. And that's basically the way he goes in his idea, in his mythological interpretation of Jesus' life. By myth, he doesn't just mean it didn't happen, though in fact he means that. He means a timeless religious truth has been written in a historical form, sometimes using legendary material. The story tells something true, but really wasn't a historical event. For instance, in the deity of Christ, in the incarnation of Christ, in the biblical teaching that Christ is fully God and fully man, Strauss claimed that this teaches the most important idea that man has ever learned theologically, and that is that man and God are the same. Man is really God, that God is really man. An idea that comes up again and again in liberal theology, that we really have a spark of the divine in us, and that therefore we're not innately bad. We just need to learn some things. We need to recognize our divinity and such. And you find that not only in liberal theology, it's a very, very common idea in Eastern religions as well. You're okay. There's a spark of the divine within you. You can fan it to fire, etc. Sort of idea. Well, we see that already in Strauss as well. Strauss's mythological interpretation of life of Christ is not accepted right away. In fact, Strauss loses his assistantship or something of that sort, different terminology in German universities. He loses that position, goes to another university, loses that position. By then his father has died, who is very wealthy and who inherits the fortune. Then his mother dies and he inherits the rest of the fortune, etc. He doesn't need a teaching position, and he spends the rest of his life living fairly well off and writing another Life of Christ later in his life and some other things like that. But we see that people at his time weren't ready for those ideas. But the ideas didn't disappear. They simmer around, and they begin to come back again. And in this century, Rudolf Bultmann, probably the most influential liberal theologian of the century, has brought back many of those ideas in a slightly different form. That somehow the idea of the deity of Christ doesn't mean he's really God, and that you convert the historical material in Scripture into some kind of philosophical material. It's always true. Now, Bultmann interprets it in terms of what we call existential theology, and Strauss interprets it in terms of what we call idealistic theology. And we haven't got time enough to discuss those, and I'm not sure I could do a great job anyway. I'm not a philosopher. Those are the names. I want to look around. We see again here something important here. It's the setting up of ideas that are going to be looked at by later New Testament scholars and begin to have influence down the line, though they're strongly rejected right at this time by the scholars and strongly rejected by the people at that time as well. Let's move on then to Ernest Renan. These three men have all been Germans. Some people are going to try and blame the Germans for all of this. I think we need to be very careful about that. There's plenty of sin in all of us, and we're all capable of really making a mess of our lives if we're willing to ignore God and go our own way. I think what we do see going on here is, one, the Germans were broken up into little states and each had their university, so lots of people doing university work, and they needed to have new things to think about, new things to work on, and they were working on a lot of areas like this. They had rejected certain features of Christianity and had to justify them, and so they went out doing so, began to put together things of the sort. I think you can see from what's going on in this century where some of the things that Hitler is doing in the next century come from. That what these men do eventually wrecked the Orthodox Church in Germany. So there's really nothing there to stand when Hitler comes forward with his own ideas, which are a resurgence of paganism. We see something of that same sort going on in our own society today. The rejection of Christianity in the mainline denominations is leading to a resurgence of paganism. You're leading to people who are ready to commit genocide already. They're starting on fetuses now instead of Jews. They may be moving to elderly people before long. They've already started on just born babies and such. And much of it is that when you wreck any recognition or revelation, you wreck any solid basis for morality. I think that's a very crucial thing. Where that passage is located, but a helpful passage to think about in this point. Where there is no vision, the people perish. If you look at the context of that, it does not mean that if we don't have vision to build a new church, we're going to perish. It's where there's no revelation, people perish. If you look at the context, you'll see that's what it's about. And the other side of it is, those who obey God's law are happy, something like that. Well, Renan is French. Renan grew up planning to head in the Catholic priesthood. But in the university, he ran into these kind of ideas, and he decided there's no sense being a pastor in the Christian church if these guys are right. We believe they were right. Two or three different kinds of things can happen when that happens to a person. That's happened to millions of people in the last two centuries. Training for the pastorate, they run into liberal ideas. Two or three things can happen. They can continue on in the pastorate believing those things and lay low and say nothing and run a dead church the rest of their career. They can stand up at the pulpit, straighten everybody out, and get thrown out of the church immediately. They can get out of the pastorate and go various ways, sell autos, sell insurance, go teach in a university, teach theology in a university, various things can happen. All those different things can happen. Some of them produce dead churches, some of them have produced heretical seminaries, and others have produced car sales. Different ways things can go. Renan became professor of Semitic languages at the College of France, and in 1863 he turned out his work, which we'll call The Life of Jesus. It's actually got the same name in French, and I'm not going to attempt pronouncing French. It's not a language I studied. The difference between Renan, Strauss, Paul, and Lamarck is not only that this fellow is French and no German, this fellow writes a reasonable length Life of Christ, and he writes it for the average educated person instead of for university professors. The result is, his book has been in print nearly the whole time since 1863. At present, it's in print in the Modern Library series in English. George Eliot, an English writer, translated in English. And, as I say, intended for any educated persons. Renan noticed that when he took the miraculous out of the life of Jesus, the life of Jesus didn't make sense anymore. And that's been a problem all down through these lives of Jesus. When you remove the miraculous, what you've got left doesn't make sense. Most people seeing that throw two-thirds of what's left and wind up with a very one-sided Jesus. Jesus is a nice, moral teacher, like a Sunday school teacher. Why would anybody put him to death? Jesus is a revolutionary. Another alternative. Where'd all the teaching come from? Jesus is a Gnostic magician. We'll look at a fellow who believes that in the next hour here. And then trying to figure out where lots of material comes from. Not very easy to see. What Renan does is he takes the material that's left over and he reorganizes it chronologically and gets three very different Jesuses that represent changes in Jesus' personality at two crucial events in his career. His Jesus started out like a Sunday school teacher, going into Galilee and charming all these people with his talk, teaching about love, and all of these young Galileans are following him around and excited about what he's teaching. And then when he goes to Jerusalem, he runs into the Pharisees. And the Pharisees aren't ready to hear any frip-frap about love. They want to see whether he's theologically sound or not. And they're not willing to listen to him. They don't agree with him. And when Jesus runs into that resistance, he realizes the only way to solve things is to have a revolution. And so he becomes a revolutionary to get rid of the Pharisaic and Sadducean status quo, those who are stopping people from living the right kind of lives. And so according to Renan, Jesus begins to work fake miracles in the second part of his career. The miracle material comes from here all fraudulent miracles, well, maybe not from the beginning. But here are lots of fraudulent miracles rather than resurrection, and that's what's going on in this middle period. And then after a while, Jesus realizes it's going to be found out. He can't keep up this forever. And so he decides that what he needs to do is die and found a new religion, become a martyr and found a new religion. So that starts the third stage of Jesus' career, the martyr stage of his career, and gives up any idea of coming to dominate the country and give up his life and become a martyr. And so he trains his followers in the baptism and the Lord's Supper and all of that and allows himself to be caught and die on the cross. And according to Renan, this all worked out a great deal better than Jesus had any right to expect because Mary Magdalene has a hallucination a few days later and thinks she sees Jesus risen from the dead. And so instead of becoming a martyr, he becomes a resurrected saint and starts off Christianity in that whole direction. We've got one last to look at right here. Wilhelm Rheda. We're back to the Germans again. Reimarus, Paulus, Strauss, Rheda. We jump on now to the beginning of the 20th century. Rheda is not one to write the life of Christ. You see the change happening down here. It's a rather important one. And that is people writing lives of Christ begin to quit early in the 20th century, at least liberals begin to quit writing lives of Christ. Because gradually as we go down the line here, a consensus is developing among liberal New Testament men that the material is less and less reliable. And back here, many, many people thought, yep, the New Testament's okay, but all these creeds people have been making out of it, they're all wrong. By the time you get down here somewhere and say, well, no, the New Testament's got all the stuff written by Paul. He started a new religion. You've got to go back to the Gospels. And by the time you get out in the middle of the century here, which of the Gospels is best? And they throw out John. Maybe Matthew's the best. And by the time of Rheda, early 20th century, the idea has arisen Mark is the best Gospel, and the others can't be really trusted. And then Rheda claims, well, there are theological ideas in Mark that don't go back to Jesus. In fact, the name of his work, rather than being some kind of life of Jesus, is the messianic secret in the Gospels. And he sees in Mark that Mark has Jesus telling people not to tell people that he's the Messiah. He says, why on earth would anybody do that? Well, we'll see next hour that Schoenfield has an idea why somebody might do that, but Rheda couldn't come up with anything. And so he decided that Jesus had never told anybody he was Messiah. Jesus didn't think he was Messiah. And that's why the writer of Mark has to make it a secret. Because how else to explain why nobody knew Jesus was Messiah? Jesus told them to keep it quiet. And so what Rheda really winds up doing is saying you can't even trust the Gospel of Mark. Chronological framework of Mark, the theology of Mark, that's all invented by Mark. All that you got left are these little stories in Mark. And we've got to test each one of those and see which is right and which is wrong. The result is that starting shortly after Rheda's time, we have this fellow Rudolf Volkmann, who we'll say more about, but to mention right now, who begins with several other persons right after World War I to look at these stories in the Gospels and throw them out one by one. This sounds too Jewish. That sounds too Christian. This has prediction in it, and nobody knows the future. and winds up with three stories and 40 statements by Jesus. He says those are the only ones that we can really believe Jesus said. And what you really wind up with is very quickly at the rate of the more radical liberals come to the place we charge into our second lecture here. I might tell you just a little bit about myself because it's really relevant to this particular course. I grew up in Arlington, Virginia. Parents were Bible believers and attended a Southern Baptist church down there. And I attended too. And as far as I know, I trusted in Christ when I was young, went forward at about 7 years old. Don't know that I understood the gospel very thoroughly, but I suppose all of us grow in our understanding of the gospel, so I won't absolutely guarantee I was saved then. But I don't know that I ever had much contact with theological liberalism when I was young. There was, in fact, a Sunday school teacher in our church who did not believe in the miraculous, and he was teaching boys probably about early teen years. One, I think, of the very serious problems with that congregation and a serious problem with many churches today is lack of doctrinal discipline to allow people to teach who reject clear teaching of Scripture. But I was interested in science, and although I was interested in Christianity, I certainly didn't intend to go into pastorate or seminary or anything of that direction. I was interested in science. I went down to Duke University for my undergraduate work in physics, and lo and behold, Duke University is a Methodist school. About the only way you would have known it at that time was that there were several Methodist ministers on the board, and there were still required religion courses. But the required religion courses were theologically liberal. They were required to take a course in the Old Testament and a course in the New Testament. And that's really where I ran smack into this sort of thing, not in this detail, but this sort of thing. And I came to realize very quickly that if liberalism was true, Christianity was not. They're not the same religion. And that there's no use wasting one's time going to church and such. And in fact, many thousands or millions of people come to such conclusions. That's why, in general, liberal churches are not growing. They're losing members left and right. They're closing up seminaries and various other sorts of things like that. However, there are some who think, well, even if that's so, I'll go along with it and such. And those are persons who are often pastors in these churches. Naturally, they're aware that they might very well lose their job if they advertised exactly what they believe. And you can grow up in many liberal churches and not hear all of this presented in detail because they know that there are people in the congregation who would leave if that's what they said. They want their income. And so there are many, many people growing up in churches, mainline churches, where the denomination is liberal, where the Sunday school literature is liberal, but it's constructed in such a way as to try and not outrage the conservatives if possible, and where the pastor tries to do the same thing when he preaches. Now, the trouble is, it's hard to preach a sermon that that won't outrage the liberals and won't outrage the conservatives and will still say something. And the result is, they either tend to outrage the one or the other, or they don't say anything. And you get those kind of splits between them. Well, I was helped very much while I was in college by the writings of C.S. Lewis. He was the first person I had come in contact with that had faced this sort of thing and still believed Christianity was true and really had some answers on some things. I was helped by him some. And then when I got to Cornell, where I was doing doctoral work in astrophysics, I ran into a pastor up there who was a research associate in the Space Center, and he knew how to answer some of these and was having a real impact with college students. And through him, I came in contact with Alan McCray, who has been president these past years for Biblical Seminary. And through him, I eventually wound up going to seminary down the Philadelphia area. And my conclusion over the rest of my scientific career before going to seminary was that although I enjoyed science very much, there is a real need to help people see that Christianity is true, and that there's good evidence for it, and that even though the consensus of the scholarly world is against the truth of Christianity, that's because you would have an extremely tough time getting a doctorate in a liberal school in religion if you accept the miraculous, if you believe the biblical accounts. And if people give each other doctorates, in the course of a generation or two, they will eventually become the consensus, and that is basically the sort of thing that's happened. I suppose, ironically, it could be said that if I hadn't run into liberal theology, I probably wouldn't be teaching in seminary today. I think the Lord will sometimes use things in a different way than others might intend them to work out. But I think we really do have excellent evidence for the truth of Christianity, and we're going to look at some of that later on in this course. But tonight we need to continue on the present discussion here. Liberal attempts, basically, to rewrite the life of Christ, and we look last time
earlier thing. I picked five, probably nearly the five most important ones out of Albert Schweitzer's book, Quest of Historical Jesus, about five out of over 100 that he lived. And then when we come to about 1905, we run out at the end of his book. And Schweitzer, after showing the pitfalls and the inconsistencies and the arbitrariness and such of all of these, winds up writing another Life of Christ himself, which turns out to have all the same problems. And really very striking irony, if you like. If you read his book, Quest of Historical Jesus, you see that under the kind of assumptions going on here, you can get entirely different kinds of Jesuses. But that if you really take the Bible and accept what it says about the miraculous, you really will get a consistent picture. I listed for you last time the fundamentals and ran out of steam at about five, and some of you may have seen one missing from the five that you're used to or whatever. I stick on two more down here that would fit in very well. Resurrection, and that could be taken in either of two ways. The resurrection of Jesus Christ, bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ, or the resurrection of believers at his return. Neither of those would be denied by theological liberals. And the other one here is hell. That is the reality of hell and the eternality of hell. Well, these features, that doesn't describe all of Orthodox Christianity for you, but it does describe the points at which Orthodox Christianity and theological liberalism differ very, very strongly. We move on then this evening in our second session to hear from early liberal lives to recent liberal lives, and the result among mainline liberals, we might call it, I'm not sure that's a great heading here, is that they can't agree on a life of Christ. Most liberals would feel there's not enough information to solve many, many basic questions. There's not enough information to tell whether Jesus thought he was Messiah or the disciples invented that idea, or the early church invented that idea. Most of them would heartily agree that Jesus couldn't possibly have thought he was God, so that must have gotten invented somewhere along the line, in spite of the fact that it's been pointed out dozens of times, but at least several times in the last couple of generations, that some of the strongest statements about Jesus are found in the Jewish materials. That is, in the Gospel of Matthew, the most Jewish of the Gospels, and in the most Jewish part of the Gospel of Luke, you have the very strong material about Jesus' virgin birth and such. Mainline liberals often have trouble deciding what part the Jews had in the death of Christ. And general tendency to say, well, the Romans killed him. And whether the Jews had anything to do with it or not, well, that's hard to tell because Christians became anti-Semitic, and so they said more about that. And they certainly don't believe Jesus rose from the dead, but they have an extremely hard time putting an alternative in place. We saw some alternatives in it suggested. John Morris believes that Jesus remained dead if the disciples stole the body or anything. Paulus believes Jesus never died in the tomb, but resuscitated. And then at the ascension, walked off up the hill into the cloud and ultimately died. Strauss believes, I didn't explain this, I think, Strauss believes that the early disciples begin to hallucinations, which they thought they saw Jesus. And so Jesus is still in the tomb somewhere here, but the disciples thought they saw Jesus. Renan goes in the same general direction. Breda does not commit himself. Lots of different suggestions there. A coma theory, a hallucination theory, a fraud theory, and there have been some others. We're going to run into another here in just a few minutes. So what you wind up with in mainline liberals is generally questions. And part of the problem is that having rejected the miraculous, since the miraculous so permeates the life of Jesus, if you think all the miracles are unreliable, why should you think any miracles are reliable? Because you've already taken out a substantial fraction of what's there. So kind of a prejudice against miracles is really strong. However, telling somebody, I don't know what happened, is not obviously very convincing. And so in general, the person who, I don't know what happened, don't in general get any big following in that direction. The people who sell books don't say, who knows what happened. The people who sell books say, I know what happened. And you're aware of that in eschatology, no doubt, as well. You may have wonder about this or that question, but if you wonder about it in print, you won't sell the books. The guys who know how it's going to come out, they're the ones who sell the book. Well, that's what's been the case here in regard to each of my opinions. We have Hugh Schoenfeld's book, The Passover Plot. John Marco Allegro's book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, and Morton Smith's book, Jesus the Magician. And each of these guys know what really happened, though in fact they have drastically different results. Let's take just a little look at each of these. In Hugh Schoenfeld, we definitely move over into a different kind of person than we've seen in any of these. These fellows have all been either theologians or students of Eastern languages of some sort. They've all been Europeans, and actually all been Germans, with one Frenchman there. With Hugh Schoenfield, we move over to a person who's an Englishman and a Jewish background, and a person whom I suspect, though I've never been able to find out this biographical information about him, must have run into evangelical Christians somewhere. He is aware of evangelical arguments about the fulfillment of prophecy in Jesus Christ, and is apparently dissatisfied with the liberal explanation that Jesus didn't know anything about these Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah, but somehow the Christians ransacked through the Old Testament and found passages that looked like they could apply to something Jesus was supposed to have done, or invented things that Jesus did to look like things in the Old Testament and such. Schoenfield tries to take the tack that many of the fulfillments of predictions in the New Testament, messianic predictions in the Old Testament, actually happened. That they happened because Jesus intended to make them happen. Jesus fulfilled Old Testament prophecies intentionally. How does he do that? Well, Jesus is a young fellow growing up in Galilee who runs into a group which Schoenfield calls the Nazareans, but which will be sufficient for us to call the Essenes. I don't know if you've ever heard of Essenes or not. You, in fact, have certainly heard of one type of Essenes, and that's the fellows who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. Everybody by now has heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls are a collection of, maybe 15 or 20 nearly complete scrolls written somewhere between 150 BC and 100 AD, say 70 AD, by a sect, I guess we can call it, a monastic group, maybe we could call it, but a Jewish group, not a Christian group, in Palestine. They apparently had their headquarters or a camp meeting or something of that sort down near the Dead Sea. And when the Romans were coming to wipe up that area near the end of the Jewish-Roman War, about 68 AD, these fellows stuck all these scrolls in clay pots, sealed them up, and hid them in caves. And some of them got found 200 years later, and some of them might have gotten found 500 years later, but a whole bunch of them got found just since World War II. And those are the so-called Dead Sea Scrolls. And some of them just copies of Scripture. But some of them are copies of little organizational manuals of this particular group, which we can call the Qumran group or the Essenes or something like that. And we see they're very interested in eschatology, very interested in the age, very interested in what's going to happen when the Messiah comes and all of that sort of thing. And they're very interested in Old Testament prophecy. And they often interpret Old Testament prophecy in terms of themselves. And so what Schoenfield says is Jesus ran into a group like this, a group up in Galilee like this, and he began to interpret prophecy the way they did, and he suddenly decided he is Messiah. His prophecies applied to him. But instead of his assuming that they applied to him, why then God would give him the power to work miracles, he began to fake a few miracles on his own. And being a charismatic sort, he could also get people to heal themselves of psychosomatic diseases. And then he began to work out other sorts of things so that he could fulfill the Old Testament prophecies. Schoenfield never does explain exactly how Jesus managed to fulfill the Old Testament prophecy of being on the scene of history at the right time, which is a rather strong one in view of the Daniel 70 weeks, which seems to run out right at Jesus' time and something you can't really do much about. But there are several things he has trouble with in that direction. But what he does do, if Jesus decides he's the Messiah, and decides the Messiah has to die and rise again, but isn't willing to trust God to raise him again, he's going to make a plot to look like he dies and then rise again. What Schoenfield is going to do is going to take the fraudulent elements of Reimarus and combine them with the coma elements of Strauss, and intentionally get himself to go into a coma on the cross so that the Roman soldiers will think he's dead and take him down and put him in a tomb, which will be supplied by one of his henchmen, a secret plotter with him. And then that secret plotter will come back and wake him up out of the coma, and then he will appear to his disciples and carry through all sorts of things that the resurrected Messiah ought to do. And so Schoenfield works up quite an elaborate plot then where Jesus arranges to use certain techniques to have someone who's in on the plot
give his disciples a donkey, and he rides in on the donkey to fulfill Zechariah 9:9. Behold, your king comes to you, lowly and riding upon a donkey. And he controls the psychology of the situation just right, so that by having this woman pour several thousand dollars worth of perfume over his head, that it blows her treasurer's mind, and he runs off to betray him. But then Jesus controls his movements in such a way that he can only betray him just a few hours after Passover meal has been taken, in such a way that they'll only have to get him on a cross right away. And then they're going to have to get him off the cross right away because the Sabbath is coming up. So he'll be able to be on the cross just a few hours, because people could survive 3 days on the cross sometimes. Yes, ma'am. I think probably he would say they never happened. That this was where the Christians dug up this passage out of Hosea and applied it to Jesus, etc. He's rather inclined to throw away birth materials, and that's back in that area. Okay? But that again is a problem. So he's going to say what he's going to do. But that's more characteristic of what liberals do in general. They say it never happened. The Christians saw this prophecy, and so they wrote up a story to fit that. But he can't really do a very good job of that when you get there around the time of Jesus' death. So he goes in a sort of direction, trying to work. Something really happened, but it wasn't supernatural. But instead of it just being misunderstood natural, it must be fraudulent. He has Lazarus stage a death, and then comes to let him out of the tomb, etc. Yeah. Yeah. Crucifixion is predicted. That's right. There are a number of very serious problems we've shown to you there, which, of course, his reader may not think of if the reader hadn't read the Bible. I would say the biggest influence Schoenfield has had is in helping liberal Jewish people not to have to face the New Testament material. I've run into a number of people of Jewish background who are liberal and therefore really don't know the Bible very well anyway, that feel Schoenfield has explained the problems that their evangelical friends have raised for them with this or that, etc. I don't think Schoenfield has had much impact on people who know the Bible well. But if you think about it a little bit, Satan's devices don't require you to construct one device that's got to work for everybody. He's trying to keep people away from the truth. He doesn't much care what else they go into. And so he can construct a device that will turn away 1% of the people in this direction. It's an excellent tool as far as he's concerned. He can construct a completely contradictory device over here that'll turn away 4% of the people in another direction. And another one over here that'll do something else. Because his concern is to thwart what God is doing and to keep people from God and keep them in rebellion and allow them to justify themselves. And I think what we see here is a position that's not that impressive for a person who knows what the Bible says well. He can begin to think of things fairly easily that go wrong with it. And most of those, Schoenfeld will say, oh, but that didn't really happen. And you have to ask him what evidence he has that what he says happens. Well, in most cases, you can't ask him. Because you're reading his book. Where's he? You don't have any idea where he is. You just got the book, okay? And his book is having impact on other people who don't raise those questions. It's a very strong feature of publishing or of having a radio broadcast. Somebody may object to something you say, but they can't get to all your listeners. Somebody may object to something you write, but they can't get to all your readers. Very interesting situation. You publish a 500-page book refuting Schoenfeld, who's going to buy it? 500 people. And how many buy Schoenfeld? 6 million. So how many have you contacted? Well, that's the kind of problem we got. Well, so Jesus rides in on the donkey, and when he does that, the officials immediately tell he's claiming to be Messiah. They've got to do something. And it happens that they don't have the right to put people to death, so they're going to have to wind up getting permission from the Roman officials to do that. He times it in such a way that they have to get it in quick before the whole Passover week is rolling, and they've got to, so he can only be on the cross a few hours. Jesus put on the cross, and he has henchmen in the audience with a drug on a sponge. And when he says a code word, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, the guy comes running out with a sponge and puts it up, and he goes into coma. Everybody thinks he's dead. Schoenfield overlooks a slight problem, that if you go into a coma on a cross in about 20 minutes, you will be dead, because the physiology of crucifixion is such that if you don't hold yourself up, you can't breathe. And if you can't breathe, you're going to die pretty quickly, independent of what kind of coma you're in. Your brain's still got the oxygen. But, he makes that, because that's very crucial. That's the one place where Schoenfield feels Jesus slipped up. There wasn't supposed to be any spear wound in the side. They were supposed to take him for dead and take him off the cross. But they give him this thrust in the side. And this is a mortal wound, but doesn't kill him immediately. So he starts bleeding from that. Carried off the cross, put in the tomb. And Joseph Arimathea and some unnamed fellow who we'll call Mr. X, never named in the book, they come back that night. They take him out of the tomb. They move him somewhere else to try and resuscitate him. And he comes to. And according to Schoenfield, Jesus doesn't realize he's dying. So he says, tell my disciples that I'll meet them in Galilee. And Mr. X runs off to tell them. And then Jesus dies. Well, Mr. X shows up at the tomb the next morning, scares the women half to death. And before he gets all the message out, they probably, okay, they think he's an angel. Then he goes, tries to explain it to on the road to Emmaus. And actually, they don't think he's Jesus. Doesn't look like Jesus. And so he's explaining the prophecies and such to them. They're very impressed by that. And then when he comes to the house, he breaks the bread the same way Jesus does. I think at first he's Jesus. Just how he slips away at that point so as not to be further questioned. Schoenfield does not elaborate on, so I can't tell you how he does that. And then he appears to the seven disciples by the Sea of Galilee. And John says, it's Jesus. But they're all afraid to ask him if it's Jesus. And if they asked him, maybe they would have found out he wasn't. But what Schoenfield does is he plays up the accounts where there's any question about identity and says the accounts in which the identity is certain, looking at the wounds in the hands or the feet or the side, well, they were invented by her. What he's doing, very selective use of information to make a very different picture, just the way a historical novelist might write or a non-historical novelist might write. What we are going to see in these things is it's possible to write a different style story of Jesus. And obviously it's possible to use any selected subset of the information in the Gospels and throw out anything that doesn't fit your model. But that essentially is what Hugh Schoenfield does in his Passover plot. He treads far more close to the fulfillment of prophecy than most liberals are willing to do. Most liberals do not want to think about fulfillment of prophecy, certainly don't want to bring it up with their parishioners, but Schoenfield does. And Schoenfield says the striking resemblance between the prophecies in the Old Testament and Jesus is not because the Old Testament guys knew anything about the Messiah, but because Jesus thought he was Messiah, thought these were messianic prophecies, and he took them and he applied them to himself, and he had to go do some of them to make them actually come out. Well, Schoenfield then would be one sample of a Passover plot, a very strong plot theory of Jesus' ministry. And like most plot theories, a plot theory is immune to data. Any data that fits the plot is in favor of it. Any evidence that is against the plot shows how carefully it was covered up. And so if the evidence absolutely fits nothing in the plot, it's a perfect plot. It's perfectly covered up. And if the evidence fits a lot of it, why then the plot kind of wasn't too well covered up, etc. Schoenfield actually claims that the author behind the author of the Gospel of John was in on the plot and knew some of the things, and he mentioned several characters whom Schoenfield then uses as significant figures in the plot and such. So Schoenfield makes a lot of use of the Gospel of John. Well, that is Hugh Schoenfield's Passover plot. Publication date was, I think, 68, though I better go look for it here. 66, sorry. 1966. Well, if you think Hugh Schoenfield's Passover plot, wait till you hear about John Marco Allegro's Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. This work was published in 1970. John Marco Allegro was, again, a professor in an English university. In fact, both of these guys were on the International Dead Sea Scroll team. Both of them had quite good scholarly reputations before they wrote these books. I think their books did not help their scholarly reputation at all, in either case, even though they're both liberal, because they were rather outlandish sorts of suggestions. What's outlandish about John Marco Allegro's Sacred Mushroom and the Cross? If you remember back in the 1970s, you know that the big thing at that time was drugs, and that's what the Sacred Mushroom is about in its title, a particular mushroom that's very poisonous. If you eat much of it, the Amanita muscaria. But if you eat a small enough amount of it, it causes hallucinations. Sort of the ancient form of LSD, a form of LSD that has been, it's not LSD, but a form of hallucinogen that has been used off and on over the centuries. And the other thing people were into in the 1970s was sex. And so John Marco Allegro writes a book supposedly about Jesus, which is basically claims that Christianity is a mushroom fertility cult or a hallucinogenic fertility cult. His plot theory, as I pointed out, is considerably more radical than Schoenfield is, because according to Allegro, Jesus never existed. Not only did Jesus never exist, Christianity never existed. Not only did Christianity never exist, Judaism never existed. Now, obviously, those last statements sound a little wild, so let me give you an opportunity here as explanation. What Allegro claims is that there was a secret group who used these hallucinogenic mushrooms, who have hallucinations, who were involved in a fertility religion which emphasized sexual activity, but because they wanted to cover these things up, because neither of these were looked upon favorably by the officials at that time, they disguised it all with code words. And so the Old Testament and the New Testament consist of thousands of code words that really point back to mushrooms and fertility cults and all that sort of thing. Now, Allegro is well capable of snowing most of his audience because he has some ability to use Latin, Greek, Arabic, Persian, Syriac, Hebrew, Aramaic, Sanskrit, Ugaritic, Akkadian, Sumerian. So anybody that's not a linguist is going to be snowed by 100 pages of linguistic notes in the back of his book. But what Allegro is really trying to do is he's trying to just take certain words in the New Testament, certain words in the Old Testament, and show how you can transform them by going back through four or five languages to the Sumerian language from about 2000 BC, and show that you get words that have to do with sex or words that have to do with mushrooms. This may sound like a pretty impressive thing until you see his technique for doing it. First of all, he points out that most of those languages, once you get behind the Greek and the Latin, don't have vowels written. So you throw away all the vowels in any of these words you can work with. Hebrew words, Greek words, throw out the vowels. Second step. We know that consonants of words change over time. If you've ever spent any time studying linguistics, you know about Grimm's rule, how the D and the T and the TH, etc., can transform from one to another. And you can find examples of that if you compare German with English or Dutch with English or something like that. And there's a whole set of consonantal changes that come from the language. So he's allowed to change any of those consonants, and he changes a few that run outside those lines as well. Then again, one of these languages, the Sumerian, maybe I'll write that here. Sumerian language is the ancient language of the lower parts of the Tigris-Euphrates River down in the top of the Persian Gulf. These are the earliest people we know of that had writing. They wrote in what's called cuneiform, the kind of writing that's made by punching into a clay tablet with the end of a device and gives a little wedge shape. Cuneiform is actually Latin for wedge shape. And the Akkadian language, which was used by the Assyrians and Babylonians later, is a very different language, but it borrowed this writing system. But it didn't borrow the writing system in a consistent way. It did two different kinds of things. Sometimes it took the letter that represented the same syllable here, and it made it represent the same syllable here. But since each of these letters down here, each of these symbols down here represented a syllable, which was usually a word in Sumerian, sometimes they took it to represent the same word in Akkadian, which was pronounced spelled very differently. So they had two different ways of borrowing letters, borrowing symbols from here to there. And so, when Allegro gets back to here, he can go either way. So up here he's thrown away the vowels, changed the consonants, he's occasionally switched them around, called metaphysis. Now he gets down here, he can go either these two ways, and he gets back to a Sumerian original. And this consists of several syllables, usually. Well, in Sumerian, nearly every syllable means something. So you can break that into several words. As it happens, we have no idea what the Sumerian word for Amanita muscaria, the sacred mushroom, is. So instead he makes all kinds of puns on fuzzy and red and umbrella-shaped and various other sorts of things, which are descriptions of the Amanita muscaria, but could come from anything else as well. And of course, for fertility religion, anything about male or female or animals or plants or something, that can be used. So he has quite field day. I'm not going to give you any great example of this, except to mention, I've got one worked out here on page 37 of my syllabus. He starts with Barnabas, and he says, New Testament explains Barnabas as the son of consolation. But we don't know any words in Aramaic that mean son of consolation. We, of course, know the word bar means son, but we don't know any novus, which means consolation. Well, of course, we don't have a very big vocabulary in the Aramaic language at New Testament time, so we don't know what words they might have had that haven't survived to us. But he says, well, it doesn't mean that. So, it must be a code word. So he takes bar for, he could take bar for sun, but he finds that bar can also mean skin in Sumerian. So we're somehow assuming that the person up here at 1st century AD knew what the Sumerians were doing in 2000 BC. He takes the one side skin. Then he messes around with Nabas, throwing out the A and the U. It's NBS. And by fooling around with the consonants a little bit, he gets him down to NGZ. And then he flips to him around and gets ZGN. And he shows in Sumerian this represents a precious stone, which is speckle-colored. And since the mushroom is speckle-colored, it must refer to that. So son of consolation refers to the consoling abilities of hallucinogenic mushroom. And the speckle-colored skin is a reference to the hallucinogenic mushroom. Well, there are hundreds of those things in the book. And I don't think there's any danger that Allegro's book will be a popular book even now anymore, much less 20 years from now. However, it had an influence on people at that time. People thought, perhaps those who had a few too many LSD and who did not use too much logic, that he had really proved something. He'd really explained away something that allowed them to go do what they want. And unfortunately, there are too many of us in the world that if we feel it's okay to do something, we won't get punished for it, we'll go do it. There are many people looking for excuses to get away from judgment. Of course, the rather dangerous thing about that is if the judgment's really coming, you better know about it and do something about it, not explain it away and live in a fool's paradise until it happens. But basically, that, I think, is what Allegro has done. Did Allegro really believe this? I haven't got any idea. He may never know the judgment, or he may be willing to admit that he just did it to sell books. He got the sold by a few. But I have no idea whether he believed it or not. But it's an example of something that is really off the wall. Many, many both liberal theologians as well as conservative theologians thought so as well and wrote a complaining letter to the Times of London or some such place about the thing. But the people who bought the stuff in the paperback bookstores had no idea what people were saying in the Times of London. They don't read the Times of London. They go around to the paperback bookstores. And there's more off-the-wall stuff in there than you could find hardly anywhere else. And both of these are big bookstores, paperback bookstores. Last of all, we come to Morton Smith. Morton Smith is American. They're playing American heretics. You don't have to go to Europe to find them. Smith is professor of ancient history at Columbia University. He got trapped in Israel during World War II when everything got shut down, the U-boats and such, and so went on and did a doctorate at Hebrew University. And then when he came back, he got a doctorate of theology at Harvard, so he's thoroughly trained. In fact, the striking thing about these three guys is they have very impressive academic credentials, and yet their material is really rather off the wall. Of the three, however, Smith, Jesus, and Magician, looks like at first sight it may have better evidence than some of the others do. He's, of course, aware that the biblical material has Jesus doing miracles. Allegro pays no attention to that. Jesus is just code word. So doesn't really do much in explaining why these code words all fit together and make sense in the context and why they change life and such. Schoenfield has Jesus out there intentionally doing miracles, but still has a slight problem of having to have a lot of them be faked miracles and such. Basically, what Smith tries to do is claim that Jesus was a magician. He really did do something. But Smith doesn't believe in the supernatural. So Jesus didn't really do anything out there, but he was able to hypnotize people. They thought he were doing things. Doubtless most of you by now have somewhere read Mandrake the Magician, who gestures hypnotically and everybody sees things flying around and things of that sort. Apparently Smith claims that Jesus was able to do something of this sort. Smith won a trip to Palestine in the 1958, was given permission to catalog a monastery library down in one of the ravines between Jerusalem and the Dead Sea, called the Marsaba Monastery. And while he was looking through this material, he claimed he found a letter written by an early church father, about 200 AD. Now, he didn't claim that he actually found the original letter, because what he found was written in the back of a Greek book, published in the 1700s. But what he claims is a monk, copying from an older manuscript, copied this into the back pages of this printed book from the 1700s. And it was a letter written by this fellow Clement, an early Christian teacher in Alexandria, who we call Clement of Alexandria.
And in his letter, which seems to have Smith's Clement style, and seems to have an interest in the kind of things Clement had an interest in, Clement's supposedly answering questions of an acquaintance of his, and his acquaintance says, look, there are some Gnostic heretics. Gnosticism was another early heresy surrounding Christianity in the second century. There's some Gnostic heretics who claim that they have the real Gospel of Mark. And it's got all these things about Jesus doing magic and stuff in them. And Clement, in his letter, says, well, they're wrong, they're heretics. But we do have a longer volume, a longer manuscript of Mark than what's let out for the public. And the secret one we've got has these additional things in it, and these two or three other things. So, what Smith says is, here I have found early evidence that that there really was a secret mark. And the secret mark gives him hints, which he says point to Jesus being a magician rather than being what the Bible represents him as. Now, actually, as Smith works through this manuscript, he claims that when you reconstruct Mark on the basis of Clement's statements and a couple of quotations he gives, you get a mark which apparently doesn't go back to the original mark, but which has been added to what he thinks it was added to by somebody who knew what Jesus really was. And so he's developed a rather elaborate theory out of this one letter that Jesus was a magician who could hypnotize his followers, and that he could pretend to fly, and they would think they're flying with him, and he flew up to heaven, and God gave him permission to invalidate the Mosaic Law, and he underwent various types of ceremonies with his followers and such. And this basically is what Morton Smith claims is going on. Since Smith claimed to make his discovery, there's been some questioning about it. The main question that's come up is that Smith has never been able to produce the manuscript he claims to have for several important tests. The biggest test that people would like to make is to look at ink on the manuscript to see whether it's 20th century ink or whether it's 18th century ink. The book, of course, was published in 1700s that this is written in the back of, but if the stuff was written in the 1700s, then we know that the story of Clement's letter is at least as old as the 1700s. It's not likely that anybody who's ever had contact with a book would be able to write a letter like this except Morton Smith himself, who is a specialist in Clement and knows what he's interested in and what kind of style he writes in. Smith claims the book has disappeared. So is the letter a letter that at least goes back to the 1700s, or maybe even goes back to Clement of Alexandria, or is it something that Smith himself forged? I don't know the answer to that. We know there was another Smith about a century earlier who cranked out several rather spectacular works that he claimed to have, which, by the way, conveniently disappeared. As far as we can tell now, he was a crook. I don't know whether Morton Smith is a crook or not. All I know from what we've got is, if you grant that what Clement says is true and that Clement really said it, all you're showing is that there was a Christian group at 200 AD that claimed to have a longer mark than we've got now. And that they claimed that this gave some of the doctrines that they believed, but which they did not let out to the public. That is, you would have a group within Christianity doing some of the same things the Gnostics were doing. Well, I wouldn't be surprised that we may have had some such groups in Christianity by that time. That would not prove that originally Christianity was anything like that, any more than by seeing what some persons in the Presbyterian churches in this country believe now would tell you anything about what the Presbyterians who founded churches in this country believed. Or what some of the Methodists were doing at Charles Wesley's time can be measured by what some of the Methodists are doing today. Churches can change drastically in 100 or 200 years, and they've done so in recent times, and they've done so in ancient times. So whether some such work existed back at that time, you really don't know. I think, however, there's some serious question whether Smith's work is really authentic or not. He cannot produce it, and there's no obvious reason why he should not be able to. And therefore, no test can be done to really check its authenticity. All we have is a couple of photographs that he took, plus a transcription that he took, and you can't do the kind of tests off of photographs that you really need to do. It's hard to tell what's going to be the importance of Smith's work